Thank you for joining us for our quarterly market update call. Joining us on the call today is Craig Bolanos, founder and CEO of Wealth Management Group. Craig, the call is yours.
Thank you so much, Lisa. It's been over a year since the COVID-19 first washed upon American shores, and while the pandemic has affected everyone to varying degrees, we can all agree that everyone's life is just a little bit different today than it was a year ago. But we now have not one, not two, but three vaccines available in the United States, and some semblance of normal is fast approaching. More businesses have reopened. I see some kids going back to school. Diners have been out back to the restaurants. Air travel's picked up. And the U.S. economy, though not back to normal yet, is poised to potentially recover most, if not all, of its lost output from last year's recession, maybe even during the first half of this year, 2021. So now that recovery is fully underway, you know, people want to know, how should we prepare for future challenges, such as changes and updates to the tax law and the code, inflation that could be rising, higher stock market valuations that are here. And to help break things down and get an update on the pulse of the market and the economy, we're pleased to be joined by Managing Director and U.S. Head of Market Strategy, Candace Say. Some of you might remember Candace because she joined us last spring at the early stages of the bear market for a very important update call. And Candace, all I can say is, wow, what a difference a year makes. And with that, Candace, I turn the call over to you.
Great. Thank you so much for having me, and thank you all for joining me again. I can't believe it has been over a year already, so I do hope that you're all staying safe and healthy throughout this pandemic. So why don't I start off with our latest outlook on the recovery? We believe this recovery is V-shaped, V for vaccine, and also will be policy-fueled. So I thought I'd start off with a quick executive summary of where we are and also where we've been. So just to give you a semblance, COVID-19 has and continues to be the key source of uncertainty across the globe. So even as we're cautiously trying to reopen here across America, we still have seen more than 133 million cases as of right now. I'm looking at my Johns Hopkins coronavirus dashboard as we speak. So the case count seemingly continues to tick higher, but as we've seen, vaccines are in place, and as of, I guess, in a couple of weeks, everyone across America will be open for vaccination, anyone above the age of 16. So the key here is there is light at the end of the tunnel. We do expect large shares of developed market populations to be vaccinated by the middle of this year, and the U.S. approaching about 50% inoculation by the end of this month. Now, how do we get there? We currently have the expectations of over 8.1 billion treatments to be available in 2021. If you compare that with the total global population, there's about 7.6 billion people around the world. So having north of 8 billion treatments means that basically if someone wanted a vaccine, they should be able to get one. However, we do know that there are some difficulties in getting the vaccines to all corners of the globe and getting them to very hard to reach areas. So with that said, we do have a number of vaccines here at home, whether it's Pfizer, Moderna, J&J, but also across the globe, there are other companies that we haven't even heard of in terms of vaccines for the U.S., like Sinopharm, Sinovac, and also, AstraZeneca, which is being the shot of choice or has been in Europe. So there's lots of different vaccines that are coming to fruition, and the projections for year-end is to hopefully have over 8 billion treatments available worldwide. Now, alongside with the light at the end of the tunnel with vaccines, we also see stimulus as another pillar of hope. What we've known to date is that the magnitude of policy support that we've received from Washington, D.C. in terms of fiscal policy, but also from the Federal Reserve in the form of monetary policy, dwarfs anything deployed in modern history. We found that monetary policy has been key in reliquifying funding markets at the peak of this pandemic, and we've also continued to see fiscal policy continue to build a bridge in terms of recoveries from corporations to consumers. And we've just seen that, you know, a large package has been passed in Washington, D.C., so fiscal policy continues, but also great accommodation from the Fed. Now, in terms of reopening, we have seen that reopening has sharply moved higher over the course of the last year. When we fell to 38% open at the peak of the pandemic early last year at this time in April, we've now seen the U.S. economy now reach around 75% reopen. So that's a huge improvement to where we were before just a year ago, but nonetheless, 75% is still not 100% fully reopen. So what we do need to reach that 100% fully reopen number is for particular sectors that have been greatly impacted by this pandemic to reopen. So vulnerable sectors like entertainment, retail, lodging, and also transportation, the reopening of these areas will be key. Now, given all of these different views on COVID, the vaccine, the continued stimulus, and the potential reopening of the greater portion of our economy, that makes us pro-risk going forward. And our view on risk assets is particularly aimed towards global equities. And our strong view on these risk assets is predicated and supported by five key thoughts. Now, what we do see is, number one, a recovering global growth of around 6.8%, so really strong growth globally. Secondly, we do expect double-digit corporate profits to happen over the course of the year, and that's globally as well, not just the U.S. And then, of course, third, we find that this is a medical emergency induced by COVID-19, so there is a limited need for structural repair as we come out of COVID-19, meaning that before COVID-19 hit last year, there was nothing inherently wrong with our financial system. There was nothing inherently wrong with the consumer or the household or the markets or pretty much anything from a macro perspective. So as we recover from COVID, there's a lack of structural need to repair significant portions of our economy. And then fourth, I would say, alongside the stimulus that I mentioned, we still think that there's sustainable policy commitments coming from Washington, D.C., and also the Fed, which remove some of the extreme risks that investors are worried about in the market. And last but not least, the fifth point which supports our views is the fact that we are still in a relatively low global interest rate environment. So that's a quick executive summary, but let me dive a little deeper into COVID-19. I know that we're here to talk about the macro economy and the markets, but I'd be remiss not to provide an update on the highest level of uncertainty that we face moving through 2021 and beyond, and that's COVID-19. So as I mentioned before, as of right now, we are at 133 million confirmed cases worldwide. In terms of the new COVID cases that have been caused by the variations of COVID-19, whether it's the UK variant, the South African variant, or the Brazilian variant, right now we're seeing about less than 25% of U.S. new cases that are coming in with the variant strain. What we do know is that we need a lot of people to have antibodies in order to reach herd immunity. And we think that about 60 to 70% plus of the U.S. population needs to be vaccinated or already have had the COVID-19 virus in order to approach this herd immunity level. Now, the good news is that it's not just Goldman Sachs that's forecasting that we can inoculate a good portion of our population over the course of the coming months, but you also have super forecasters like the Good Judgment Project placing a 98% probability that 200 million people in the U.S. can get vaccinated by the end of the second half of 2021. So, of course, it really depends on where you live because the impact of COVID-19, especially to an economy, really will be nonlinear and especially will be predicated upon how each individual country can deliver and distribute vaccination. So just to give you a semblance of the countries that are poised to have the best potential of disseminating and distributing vaccines, the U.S. and the U.K. stand high on that list, because we do have the medical infrastructure in place to fully distribute and vaccinate the people within our populations. Now, on the flip side, if you take a look at countries like India, for example, who have been greatly impacted by COVID-19, they have one of the largest populations in the world. They actually stand to benefit most because their economy has been hit, I would argue, probably one of the hardest hit economies across the globe, but yet they do lack the infrastructure that we have here in more developed nations like the U.S. and the U.K. So again, the impact of COVID-19 will be nonlinear, and so will vaccine distribution depending on the healthcare infrastructure of each economy. So with that as a backdrop, let me walk you through other areas of volatility that we're looking at over the course of the coming year plus. So So aside from COVID-19, we're also taking a look at things like the labor market. As of right now, at the end of March, we had the U3 unemployment number reach levels of 6%. So that's headline employment here in the U.S. Now, that number has greatly improved from the 14.6% that we experienced April of last year at the peak of the pandemic. So we're slowly but surely seeing unemployment numbers recover. What our expectations are is that by year end, end of 2021, we expect that labor number to greatly improve to end the year probably around 4.5%. So it will still take some time before we reach pre-pandemic unemployment levels, but nonetheless, unemployment has continued to greatly improve over time. Now, it can become a source of volatility if for some reason the labor markets take another leg down, meaning unemployment numbers start to creep up over the course of the coming months. If that should happen, that could stand to move markets and create a lot of volatility. Secondly, the other source of volatility outside of labor markets is liquidity. So if you think about the stock market, for example, 72% of U.S. stock market volume is currently being algorithmically traded. What I mean by that is that in simplistic terms, algorithmic trading refers to computer program trades. So for example, if you had some really negative headline come in one day, whether it's labor market related, whether it's COVID related, whether it's bad news about the vaccine, that could move markets down lower for the day. Now, if it reaches a substantially lower level, program trades that are pinned to that lower level will kick in, further exacerbating the sell-off. So if the market does drop, the liquidity in the market due to computer trades could actually create more volatility, dragging the market down faster and more furious than it originally was. Now, the good thing about volatility in the markets is that it also happens on the upside. So let's say we have great news, better news on the vaccine, better news on COVID-19 cases coming down, better numbers for unemployment. All of those things can meet the market higher. And again, similar to the way down, at a high level, there can be computer trades that are programmed that when the market reaches that level, all of a sudden those computer program trades kick in, and that leads the market higher, potentially leading to even new all-time highs as we've continued to see seemingly day in and day out at sometimes. So liquidity in the market does tend to create volatility as well for investors. Now, the third point of volatility is regarding regulation. If you take a look across all of the stocks that you can invest in the U.S. equity market, right now, five main companies represent nearly a quarter of the entire investment universe. So the five names are really familiar to all of us on the call. It's Facebook, it's Amazon, it's Apple, it's Microsoft, it's Google. These are all five companies that produce products and services that we have all grown accustomed to, especially over the course of the year. Well, because of this high concentration, in especially large tech names, Washington, D.C. has placed these companies on their radar. And we've seen it even with the Trump administration, where there was a huge focus on internet freedom, and even now with the Biden administration, perhaps more of a focus on antitrust regulation. So nonetheless, if regulation does come down the pipeline, because it's representing 22% of the market, that essentially can move markets on its own and bring volatility to the system. And the last point I wanted to highlight in terms of other sources of volatility is policy. You know, we are a couple months into this newly elected administration, and what we do know is that we didn't have the blue tsunami that many folks were calling for, but what we did have was a blue sweep, meaning a blue president in the Democrats. We also had, a blue House of Representatives and also a blue Senate, but only slight majorities across, the House and also the Senate. So what we do know is that in order to pass massive legislation, take, for example, the Senate, you actually need 60 votes, the majority votes, to actually go and implement a large piece of legislation. Knowing that right now we have very thin margins, there is no 60 votes that guarantee that legislation can move through. So from that standpoint, we would say it's very important for the moderate vote, in this administration to pass legislation. So there are moderate Democrats, you know, Joe Manchin being one of them. There are moderate Republicans, for example, who actually need to vote in order to move the needle as to what type of legislation gets passed. So policy in itself could create some volatility in the system. And we all know that after the fiscal package was passed, now all eyes are on the next infrastructure and tax plans that are being rolled out by the Biden administration. So those are some sources of volatility. But I don't want to leave you with just sources of volatility. I do want to talk about some areas of stability that will enable this recovery to continue. And one area of stability is something called the Financial Conditions Index, also known as the FCI. Now, the Financial Conditions Index, I would say the easiest way to explain it is it's a measure that the Fed looks at, and it's a measure showing you how monetary policy is impacting various parts of the markets. So it takes into account what the Fed is doing, but also the impact on equity markets, on, you know, rates, on credit spreads, on the FX markets. So in total, if that number is falling, it means that is very accommodative towards recovery. And what we do see is we came from a level of 102 FCI, and now we're down to 97.8. So that downward trajectory shows us that it's near all-time lows, meaning that there is great accommodation for this recovery to continue to happen, and that financial conditions are very easy, meaning allowing for investors and also the markets and the macro to recover as well. So FCI, Financial Conditions Index, supportive of continued stability and recovery moving forward. Secondly, I would say another area of stability is in corporates, and I'm talking about bankruptcy rates. As counterintuitive as that sounds, right now the number of bankruptcies in 2020 has actually decreased. Now, I know that sounds a little counterintuitive because I think at first glance, many investors may assume that bankruptcy rates have moved higher because of the pandemic, but based on the public filings of Chapter 7s, 11s, 13s, and 15 filings, we actually noticed that the bankruptcy rate is lower by 17% versus pre-pandemic levels. So again, corporations actually have a lower bankruptcy rate, a lower than 17% bankruptcy rate than it was in 2019. So that is supportive of a stable recovery. And I would say some of that can be attributed to the fiscal stimulus that has enabled some small businesses to actually stay intact throughout this pandemic. Now, the third source of stability, I would say, is the housing market. Now, for all of you who probably have joined me already in refinancing, there was $3.7 trillion in mortgage origination in 2020, reflecting the extremely low level of interest rates in this environment. And also, it showed us that there was a very strong housing market. So from that standpoint, we know that for many folks that refinanced or was able to get a mortgage at these extremely low levels, we're able to benefit from low interest rate payments for years to come. So that's the source of stability. And then last but not least, I would say a major source of stability is you and I, right? In terms of households, we have basically been saving north of 13%+ in savings rates, meaning we really haven't gone out and spent a lot of money, right? Because, you know, today I'm in the office, but I really haven't had to spend money to commute into the office. I really haven't had to fill my gas tank as much as I normally do if I did come to work or travel on an airplane to go speak with clients. And I actually haven't even gone out to eat at a restaurant in over a year. So imagine the amount of money that, you know, we've been saving just within my household because we haven't been really spending money as we normally do pre-COVID-19. So that high level of savings rate across the country literally sets the stage for a potential consumer rebound. So those are four areas of stability that we think will continue to allow this recovery to happen over the course of the next year plus. So how do these macro views in terms of volatility and stability in COVID-19 impact your portfolio? Well, if you think about your investments, let me break it down into a number of different asset classes. Let's talk about equities to start off with. In terms of the equity market, I mentioned earlier that we are actually very pro-risk from an equity perspective, particularly global equity. So not just the U.S., but also international developed equity and also emerging market equity. And the reason for this positive global equity strength is the belief that we do have a V-shaped recovery, as I mentioned, vaccine shape, that's also fueled by policy. So that's what we think will continue to support equity markets. And just to give you a glimpse, just within the U.S. equity markets alone, we think that the equity markets can continue to move higher than where we are today, potentially ending the year at levels of 4,300. So still some ways to go. And at the end of the year, we think that from beginning of 2021 to the very end, we think there is a great possibility for about a double-digit level of return from beginning of the year to end of the year. And that's also consistent across the globe where we do see opportunities for, you know, the European stock markets, you know, Asian stock markets to move higher as well. From another asset class perspective, let's talk a little bit about fixed income, and I'll focus more so on rates. So if you take a look at rates across the globe, we do think that rates will edge higher, and we do think that the long end of the curve will probably reflect a lot of the cyclical recoveries that we're seeing in the sectors I mentioned before. So from our perspective, we do see rates moving higher, particularly with the U.S. 10-year treasury rate, which is issued by the U.S. government. We think that, you know, at current levels, we can move higher towards year end to end the year at about 1.9%. In terms of currencies, our forecast is for the U.S. dollar to weaken. Now, we've seen the U.S. dollar strengthen over time, really because a lot of investors invest in the U.S. dollar as a safe haven investment. So in times when people are uncertain about what's happening, a lot of people pile into the U.S. dollar for safety reasons. And as the recovery continues to happen, we think that investors will feel more comfortable diversifying their assets into other currencies in other countries, allowing the U.S. dollar to weaken over time. And last but not least, let me hit on commodities. In terms of commodities, given where we are today, we see a new bull cycle in commodities emerging. And the reason for this emergence is we had a sudden shutdown in the economy globally. We had demand destruction happen because we were all working from home and we didn't really go out. And what has happened as a result is a lot of companies have stopped investing in supply. So now that you have this supply shortage and demand is increasing as the recovery continues, you have this mismatch. So because of this mismatch, we see a bull cycle in commodities across the board. We see crude oil moving higher by year end. We see natural gas moving higher. We see gold moving higher. We see copper moving higher. So across the commodity complex, we do see commodities in a new bull cycle in this recovery. So let me end by just reiterating some of the reasons I mentioned before. I mentioned that we are positive on risk assets. We do like equities. You know, if we had to choose, you know, we think equities does have the ability to generate, you know, better returns moving forward, but that doesn't mean that you get rid of fixed income in your portfolio, right? Because at the end of the day, you still need a core ballast in your portfolio should the environment turn more negative and there's some hiccups in the recovery. So a diversified portfolio is still best, and strategic portfolio asset allocation is key during this time of risk management. But with that said, we frame our positive views based on constructive views on what's happening right now. Based on five things that I mentioned before, our views are predicated on, number one, growth around the globe totaling north of 6.8%, which is a very solid growth for the year. Two, double-digit profit growth happening across the globe. And if you take on average across the globe, we're looking at a V-shaped global earnings recovery of 34%. And then if you take into account the third reason, that this is a medically induced, you know, recession and you know, pandemic, we do think that there is an absence of structural drivers that need to get fixed after we come out of this pandemic. Fourth, I mentioned we continue to be able to rely on fiscal stimulus from Washington, D.C., and also monetary policy from the Fed. And this allows for some of the tail risk in the market to be taken off the table for investors. And last but not least, as I mentioned before, interest rates around the globe still remain relatively anchored here in the U.S., but also globally. So those are the five main reasons why we remain constructive on this market and some of the reasons why we see this recovery continuing to happen, because there are still sources of stability while there are also areas of volatility that we'll continue to monitor. So with that, I've talked to her about 25 minutes. I want to turn the call back to the team to open it up to any questions that any of you may have for me. I'm happy to discuss anything I've covered or even topics that I didn't cover today.
No, Candace, fantastic. You know, your talking points were precise, concise, very much on point, and you answered a lot of the questions that I have, you know, somewhat in the periphery. But if I make it more direct, you know, much more explicit, you can't turn on a single financial network, whether it be CNBC, the Wall Street Journal, name them all. And what you're consistently and constantly hear is discussions of people being concerned over inflation for various reasons. Can you go ahead and talk about that inflation fear, where it stems from, and talk about whether it's equities or another source that you view are really a great hedge against inflation for those looking to get retired and stay retired?
Sure. I think that's a very valid question, and one that I would argue is one of the top questions we've been receiving from clients. And the reason for this seemingly new concern over inflation is the fact that inflation is moving higher, right? So I think we are all in the same camp in saying that inflation will tick up higher, and we'll see it start to take place as soon as this month. Right, so inflation will probably move higher this month through probably middle part of July. And the reason why I say this is because the difference in where we were last year at this point versus where we are today, that's how inflation gets monitored and measured. So knowing that we were in an extremely dire time last time this year, the base effects of basically calculating the change from a very tough environment to a recovering environment that we're in today shows you that inflation will move higher. And we think core PCE, which is the inflation measure that the Fed looks at, will move to levels of 2.4%. That's over the course of this month through probably the middle of summer. So knowing that that level has gone from, you know, 1.4%, you know, something plus percent inflation that we've seen in the last, let's say, you know, last few years, and now moving higher to 2.4%, that knee-jerk reaction alone can scare any investor, right? So in the eyes of an investor, it's like, wait a minute, we're reaching 2.4%. Inflation must be on track to move north of that, right? I think for some investors who were around in the 60s and 70s, they may remember, wow, inflation had gotten up to about 6+%. Is that where we're headed? So this might remind some investors of that time frame and bring up the concerns that inflation might get to that level. Now, our view is that we're not reaching that level anytime soon. In fact, reaching 2.4% because of the calculation from last year's tough market to now brings inflation to that level, but we do think that it's transitory. It is temporary. So as it normalizes through year end, we think we'll end the year at average inflation, core PCE, around 1.9%. So even though we'll see a tick up of inflation over the course of the next 3-4 months, we will end the year on average around 1.9%. And then our expectation for inflation is that it will stay around the 2 to 2.1% level all the way through to 2023. And that's pretty much in line with what the Fed is seeing, right? And what the Fed has come out to say is that they're going to need to see substantial, you know, changes in unemployment and also a steady period of inflation moving higher before they actually move to bring rates up. So at this point, based on what the Fed has come out to say and also what our forecasts are, we think that, you know, at the end of the day, rates will probably move higher, you know, first half of 2024, at earliest at the end of 2023. And yet the market that's fearing this inflation is scheduling a couple of hikes from the Fed over the course of the next year. So there is a disconnect between the fear of the market with inflation versus what the Fed is planning to do. And they have basically come out in the last meeting to show where they all land in terms of where they think the market is with inflation and where we think we're headed with unemployment. And Chairman Jay Powell has come out to say they don't expect to move until there is substantial activity from the unemployment front, but also a steady move higher on the inflation front. And they're happy to sit on this slightly north of 2% inflation for a while before they will consider raising rates. So in this trajectory of rising inflation, a lot of investors are wondering what they should be investing in to hedge for that inflation moving higher. And what we've seen is a lot of people have thought about things like gold as an inflation hedge. And it may have worked in the past, but out of all the times when inflation moved higher, there was really one point when gold perform really well in inflation. And that's in times when there's extremely high levels of inflation here in the U.S. And if you recall, that's the 1960s and 70s. So when inflation is about 6%+ at those high levels, gold has served as a great inflation hedge. But of course, as I mentioned before, we don't expect to get to that level anytime soon. We're still going to hang around the 2%+ range for a couple of years to come. So that's gold. Other people are looking at things like cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin as an inflation hedge. And I think that's really interesting because Bitcoin was created in 2008. So it's been in existence since the end of the global financial crisis. And it hasn't seen a time when inflation is higher than where we've been in the last few years. So I think it's very interesting that investors who think that Bitcoin or cryptocurrencies can serve as a great inflation hedge, meanwhile, we haven't even seen it being around for that long, so how would we know how would it perform in an inflation environment? What we would say is there are areas like TIPS within the fixed income market, no replacement for core fixed income in your portfolio, certainly not, but people feel that if you invest in TIPS, it can actually move with inflation and it could provide for some inflation protection. So that's an area you can take a look at, but of course there are some considerations there as well. At the end of the day for us, as we take a look at all the different asset classes that investors have traditionally hedged inflation with, we found that at the end of the day, equities, hands down, has continued to outperform and protect in inflationary periods better than of all of the other asset classes and investments that I just mentioned. So from our perspective, we still think that equities probably provides the best inflation hedge moving forward. With that said, inflation will still stay at these low levels for a while, and even if we reach 2.4% over the course of the next few months, that is temporary.
Now, Candace, and thank you for your comments. I mean, Wealth Management Group's thought leadership parallels exactly what you and Goldman Sachs just represented. Just a couple more questions that I think are very, very timely. You know, it took some 20 years for this to happen, but last year, growth stocks, led by a handful of names, as you mentioned, that comprised some 22% of the S&P market cap, had its largest year of outperformance relative to what you and I as investors would deem value stocks. Can you comment a little bit about that, why it happened? And then specifically, we've seen this ginormous rebound in what we call the reflation, the cyclical trades, those value stocks coming back. You know, is that a trade? Or is it much more of a sustainable edge where investors are going to be best served owning both going forward? What is your and Goldman Sachs opinion moving forward?
This is a top question as well. So we are getting questions on whether or not this is the transition to the value style for the next decade. And the short answer is no. The reason why we've seen value and cyclicals outperform is based on the vaccine and the recovery, right? So as we move further into this recovery, those sectors that I mentioned that have been hit the hardest, lodging, entertainment, transportation, leisure, those are the areas that stand to benefit most, right? Because they haven't recovered yet. We've seen the other parts of the markets recover throughout this pandemic in the last year, but this is a portion of the market that still hasn't fully recovered, right? Imagine cruise lines, right? And how many of us are signed up to go on the next cruise? I think we're still, you know, limited in that standpoint, but for folks that are investing in the future and with the recovery, people are believing that those particular areas have the ability to recover now that there's a vaccine, now that we're moving more towards normalcy. So those sectors have done very, very well. So if you're tracking the recovery, if you're tracking the vaccine, the closest proxy to that is the value space and the cyclical areas of the markets that have performed well. And the reasons why they perform well is because of belief in the vaccine and the recovery. So that's why they've done well. We still think they have the wherewithal to continue to do well. So if you don't have value within your portfolio, I would recommend that you own some value because the markets are moving higher. These sectors are recovering. So if you don't want to miss out on that recovery in this portion of the market, you need value in your portfolio. But just because value is outperforming doesn't mean that growth performance goes out the window. It's not one for the other. What we have seen over the many years is that these tech names that I mentioned have actually produced products and services that you and I have come to really use, right? So whether it's this pandemic that has driven us to open our Netflix accounts or start ordering from Amazon Prime or get our groceries delivered to our doorstep, some of those habits will not go away even when the pandemic is over. Like some of us are so ingrained in Amazon Prime, for example, my husband and I, we have packages seemingly coming every single day. So that activity probably won't stop. So many of these companies that have done well have products that have enabled them to generate great profits, generate great revenues and earnings. And from that standpoint, has allowed these companies to really get the backing from investors that, you know, they want to invest in companies with strong balance sheets, with strong cash flows, with strong business models. So I don't think that's going away anytime soon. So I would say you need both. You need growth and you need value because growth is not going anywhere. Many of these companies are strong and will still continue to perform. There may be times when they may sell off because the market is more focused on the recovery and these value and cyclical stocks. But at the end of the day, you know, I have two young kids at home, 4 and 8, and I oftentimes read them a story that many of you are familiar with, right? There's a story of the tortoise and the hare. So from the perspective of that story, we all know that the tortoise is slower moving. It's the steady eddy kind of animal making its way to the finish line. And I would account that to growth, right? That's sort of the steady eddy investment that seemingly right now is moving slower. And then the hare, whoa, all the speed we've been seeing, right? The sharp moves higher, the sprinting, you know, the jumping, right? That's the hare, and I would equate that to value. So if you want to get in and follow what's happening in the market now with the sharp moves quickly moving higher, that's value. If you want that slow and steady growth level, that's, you know, the tortoise, and that's growth. So at the end of the day, as an investor, we would say you need both in your portfolio. Just because one does better than the other doesn't necessarily mean that growth is not going to perform anymore. We still think growth has legs. So I would say you need both in your portfolio.
Thank you. Now, Candace, this wouldn't be a timely call if we didn't discuss this. Now that we're past the ARP, you know, the American Rescue Package, and we're moving on towards infrastructure, a core component of that infrastructure bill, you know, that may or may not happen, is, of course, not necessarily front-loaded economic gains, but economic gains that might be dragged through over the course of a decade. But part of that spend is going to be done, in theory, through a revenue raise that's higher corporate tax rates. That's going to affect earnings per share, higher tax rates on certain individuals relative to their marginal bracket and surtaxes. How much of that has the market already priced in? And what, if anything, do we need to be aware of relative to potential regulation, relative to, in this case, the direct question, higher corporate taxes that are going to be pending?
Sure. I think that's a great question, very timely, being that, you know, the fiscal stimulus package was just passed through, so now all eyes are on the infrastructure proposal. We do know that, you know, what's being proposed is going to be a large package, you know, approximately $2 trillion plus over the course of the next 10 years. We know that there are proposals for cleaner energy, a bigger focus on things like renewables and climate transition. So all of those things are under consideration at this point. From a taxation perspective, meaning how are we going to pay for these packages, it does come down to increasing taxes. And I don't think it's any surprise to anyone because President Biden had run on the platform all throughout his campaign that if he made office, he would raise taxes. So what we do see is the proposal for corporate tax rates to move higher. Now, President Biden has proposed a 28% tax rate, 28% tax rate increase for corporate taxes. But what we do know is that, again, you don't have the 60 votes in the Senate to easily pass that 28%. So we think with the way the Senate is structured now with a razor-thin majority, we actually expect that that number looks a little more like 24% or 25%. So potentially it won't be the full 28% that the Biden administration is proposing, but nonetheless, it will come in the form of increased corporate taxes around 24-25%, plus an increase in the taxation for international corporate income earned by U.S.-based companies outside of the U.S. From an individual's perspective, we do expect that, you know, everything that was passed through with TCJA with the Trump administration in 2017 will probably get removed, right? And on top of that, I think that cap gains rate will actually move higher. And then there's also potential for estate taxes on assets over $1 million to be increased as well. So from an individual perspective, expectations are, you know, individual tax rates will move higher, particularly for higher income earners. Now, the key here is that this is not going to happen probably this year, and we don't think it will happen retroactively as well. So when it does kick in, it'll probably kick in 2022 at earliest, and then probably phase in 2022, 2023, 2024. Now, the market impact basically depends on, you know, where the increase in tax rate happens and what the final percentage is. But if you think about the corporate tax rate, if it increases to, let's say, 25%, that would be a 3% reduction in 2022 S&P 500 EPS, and that would be also a bigger impact to multinational companies. So if he was able to input the 28% corporate tax rate, it would be a 9% hit, but because it's only, let's say, 24-25%, we think the hit to EPS here in the U.S. will be 3%. And then, of course, cap gain tax changes may create, you know, more work for you and your team, because that will lead to more asset allocation decisions that may have to happen, and also tax loss harvesting conversations that probably would need to happen with your clients. And then, of course, if you think about individual tax policy, that's going to impact supply and demand dynamics, particularly in areas like the municipal bond market. So lots of potential, you know, impacts across the board, but we do think that, you know, what we do know is that taxes will probably be moving higher. It's just a matter of what percentage that is, and it will impact different parts of the market.
Absolutely. But when we risk score that out, that in itself isn't going to be enough to go ahead and erode, you know, this bull market that is here. I think it's somewhat priced in. And everybody who will be listening to this certainly knows that the wealth management crew prides itself on forward-looking risk management relative to the income tax side. We do taxes every single day, so we're good to go. Candace, you already told us there's not a bubble in the market, but I'm closing with that question, because even though you were very reassuring throughout your thought leadership today that there is not a bubble in equities, can you explain very, very briefly and reconfirm no bubble? And why is it that people are representing there's a bubble? Because Goldman Sachs just doesn't see it, and your views don't align with that either.
Sure. So I think the reason why, the main reason why a lot of people are calling for a bubble is because the stock market has gone higher for so long, right? So I think that in itself leads people to believe, wow, it has to end at some point, and it might end sooner rather than later. Well, if you take a look at where we are today, if you look at valuations, I would say, yes, hands down, from a valuation perspective, markets are expensive. But I wanted to remind folks that markets can be expensive for many, many years. Just think where we are today. For the last 10 years, the market has been this expensive for a decade. So if you take a look at all the different metrics that you can use to value the market, whether it's forward PE, whether it's CAPE ratio, whether it's price to book, EV, EBITDA, all of those metrics that you can use to price the market show us that we are, you know, the 94th percentile to 100th percentile in expensiveness, meaning this is probably one of the most expensive times in history just based on those metrics. And so people think it can't last that long, but we do know it can. So for the last 10 years, markets have remained expensive, yet markets have continued to move higher. We were up extraordinarily over the course of the last 10 years, just investing in equities alone. And we do think that the ability for that to continue to happen is pretty great, because even though we've experienced, you know, the 70%+ return since the bottom of the market last year in March, compare that with the last four expansionary cycles where you actually had on average, and you're taking, you know, a median count of these four last expansionary cycles, you're looking at north of 400% returns just within the equity space alone. So being at 75% increase in the market is very different from where the last four expansionary cycles are. Now, keep in mind, as an investor, you're not going to be 100% invested just in equities or one stock, right? Because that's, you know, not the best decision in terms of not being diversified. We do wholly back and you know, always do recommend that clients think about diversification. Diversification may not work every time, but it tends to work over time. So as I mentioned before, equities can do really, really well and still do really well, but you also still need components of fixed income and other asset classes to sort of balance out your portfolio. So from that regard, you know, a lot of clients are worried about a bubble because markets are expensive. They're worried about the bubbles because they think the markets have gone too high for too long. But again, as we've seen in the past, valuations can be high, and it can be high for 10 years like we've been in. But even before this period in the 1990s, that period of high valuations lasted for 20 years. So high valuations can last for a long time. Markets still have legs to move higher. This is just the beginning of the recovery, just the beginning of this new bull market, new expansion. So we still think that this bull market has lots of room to run, and there's nothing inherently screaming that shows a bubble that's imminently about to burst. We're monitoring a number of things. You know, things that we monitor include, you know, valuation, as I mentioned, but we're also looking at things like ISM in terms of manufacturing and services. We're looking at the labor market. We're looking at the credit market. We're looking at private sector balance. And what we are seeing is that, you know, for the most part, if valuations are flashing red, everything else in total and in aggregate is showing that we have a moderate chance of a bear market, meaning that the market will drop precipitously lower 20%+ and then some at this point. So we do think that this recovery still has legs and this expansion can continue to move forward despite the concerns that I just mentioned.
Candace and Goldman Sachs, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for your partnership with the Wealth Management Group. To everyone who's taking the time to listen to this market update, we remain daily vigilant. We obviously remain proactive in our forward-thinking tax strategies, and we will do whatever is needed to help you and your loved ones get retired and stay retired. Thank you for your business. Lisa, I'll let you conclude our call at this time.
Thank you, Craig. The opinions voiced on this call are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. The economic forecasts set forth may not develop as predicted. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult with your financial advisor prior to investing. Securities are offered through LPL Financial, member FINRA SIPC. Goldman Sachs is not affiliated with Wealth Management Group or LPL Financial. Thank you.